What would a rover for an icy moon look like? Which moon should we replace the moon with? Why put a telescope on the moon? And what's the probability of Artemis II launching in February? All this and more in this week's Question Show. It's time for the Question Show. Your questions, my answers. As always, wherever you are across my channel, if a question pops in your brain, just write it down. I'll gather them up and I will answer them here. Enjoy the set of moon-related questions. Casey Ream. What would rovers for moons or dwarf planets with icy surfaces look like? Would they move more like snowmobiles? Yeah, that's really interesting. We're very familiar with just the straight up the rover, the four-wheeled, maybe the six-wheeled rover that is, you know, designed to roll around on regolith, maybe find the occasional rock and drive around it. But the engineers at NASA and ESA and the Chinese Space Agency have been working on different kinds of vehicles for different kinds of surfaces. And, you know, I've covered them in bits and pieces, and I keep meaning to do an episode about all of the really amazing extreme ideas for rovers that have been proposed. And I'm just going to sort of run you through a bunch that I really like, because it's beyond just like navigating on a snowy surface. Because with a snowmobile, if you've ever ridden on a snowmobile, like part of it is the velocity that you are moving very quickly and you're trying to skim above the surface. But, you know, it's probably not that we're going to find snow, like freshly fallen snow powder, right, on the surface of Enceladus or Europa or something like that. These are places that have been covered by ice. The ice has been exposed to the vacuum of space for millions, some cases billions of years. It's getting pounded up by micrometeorites. And so in some cases, it is being turned into something that it would be analogous to snow, but not sort of light and powdery, but more like crushed up corn snow. It's, you know, we have many different names for snow here in Canada, but like little balls. So think regolith, but now it's snow or ice, right? Little just pulverized ice into this sort of really kind of powdery ice. But then there are these features, and I apologize, I forget the name of them, but there are these ice spikes that appear. And we have the conditions here on Earth. You find them on glaciers, on mountains, and they sort of build over time. And it looks like a whole bunch of spikes. And that those same features are thought to be on the surface of places like Europa and Enceladus. So it's not going to be this fresh powder. And so, you know, you're thinking of an idea like, would it be a snowmobile? You know, maybe, but probably not. You would want some kind of rover or vehicle that could drive across those kinds of landscapes. If you're lucky, your wheeled rover will work, but you're probably going to want bigger wheels. If you're not lucky, then other kinds of locomotion start to make more sense, like some kind of hopper. There was an interview that I did with a researcher who was working on a hopper for Enceladus, and that this is a one-legged hopper that's able to maintain its orientation, and it's able to jump around on the surface of, you know, right now it jumps on the surface of the Earth, but in theory, it could jump around on the surface of Enceladus and maybe even jump around or even through the various plumes that are coming out of the surface of Enceladus. So maybe you just like always are staying on the move. And these hopper spacecraft have been proposed. And I think the Chinese are actually planning to do a test of one of these hoppers, not a one-legged jumper, but a vehicle that's designed to essentially leap off the surface of the moon, perhaps assisted by a rocket briefly, coast for a while on a ballistic trajectory, and then drop down onto the surface at a new location and then examine its surroundings there. And then you don't really have to be concerned about the intervening terrain. You just leap off the surface, float through the vacuum of space, land softly somewhere else, and now you've got new stuff around you. And then, you know, maybe you can control, you know exactly where it is that you're trying to go. Like you've got some kind of map of the area of where all of the interesting geological features are, and then you just leap off the surface of the moon, drift briefly down and land right beside that rock that you really want to explore. But there's been some other really interesting ideas. So there are snake bots, which not only would allow you to sort of make it across fairly varied terrain, right? If there are those spikes, if there are large rocks, if there are ice crevices, you can make your way across these kinds of things. But also you can go down into caves, small caves, things like that. And, you know, there are lots of really interesting snake bot designs. There's a rover that NASA is working on that is designed to crawl along the underside of ice. And so you imagine, like, there's the ice sheets down at the bottom of the Earth, like at Antarctica, and that this rover is a rover, but it's upside down. So it's buoyant, and its wheels are directed up, and now it's just driving around on the bottom of the ice looking for life. And you can imagine a similar thing. You know, maybe, perhaps you drill down through the ice on Europa or Enceladus, and you deploy this rover. So there's a lot, and like, I'm just scratching the surface. Just so many great ideas for rovers to deal with difficult terrain. There are repelling bots. So, you know, perhaps you want to explore a cliffside. Then one rover anchors itself to the top of the cliff and then extends a line down. And then this other rover is able to crawl down the side of a cliff. And you could also use that, for example, going down into a lava tube. So rovers are great if the terrain is really safe. But the problem is that the most interesting places to explore often have unsafe terrain, and that we're going to need entirely new paradigms for vehicles that can actually explore those kinds of places. But yeah, it's all very exciting. It's time to shout out our new patrons at the $5 level and above. Astrolad, Joppel, Johannes Rath, Nadim Selick, Astrophotography, McCoig, Jay Watson, Stefano Landi, Flyer27, and Ion Drive 3D. Join our community at patreon.com/universe today. Walleye Cottage Fishing Channel. If you could replace our moon with any other moon in the solar system, which one would you choose and why? That is rough, because there are moons that I like better than the moon. But the problem is that is because they're in the location that they are. So you think about, say, Titan or Enceladus or Europa or Ganymede or Callisto or all of these moons. If you moved them to be the Earth's moon, then they would grow a tail, and the radiation from the sun would wear away all of the ice and water that surrounds them, all of the nitrogen and the methane and all that kind of stuff. It would just wear all that away, and you would be left with the rocky core underneath. And so you would turn Titan into the moon. You would turn Europa into the moon. Like, you would just end up with this ball of silica and metal. So I can't think of a moon that, if we switch places and put it to be in orbit around the Earth, that it would still look really cool. Like, all of the cool, Charon, Triton, they have to be kept in their current environment to be as interesting as they are. Now, if I just wanted to, like, briefly throw one of these moons in orbit, then I'd probably choose Iapetus, I think, is sort of like the one that I'm most fascinated with. It's that yin-yang moon where half of it is covered in snow and the other half is like charcoal and has this weird ridge on it that is 20 kilometers high. It's a very bizarre, you know, mysterious moon and one of the places in the solar system that I'm most fascinated by. So that, but then we need to put it back very quickly. Otherwise it would lose its charm and it would just become this, the moon again. A fish. What would be the unique advantages of a telescope on the moon? Best opportunity for a big interference telescope. So I've actually done a whole interview here on the channel with a researcher who has put together a proposal for the European Space Agency about different kinds of telescopes and stuff that they could do on the moon. And so we kind of cover all our bases on that. The best use of a telescope on the moon is that you put something on the far side of the moon, like a large radio telescope on the far side of the moon. And that lets you observe the signals from the early universe without them being influenced by any radio interference from planet Earth. The problem is that radio signals are everywhere. You know, you are probably wearing at all times several things that are giving off. I carry three, my watch, my headphones, and my phone at all times, right? And I am just a source of radio interference, and the whole planet is just terrible. So you go to the far side of the moon, you're now blocking the Earth's radio interference with the mass of the moon, and the moon doesn't have an atmosphere. So even if there are some wavelengths that are fine, you know, even on the surface of the Earth, there are others that you still want to have no atmosphere. So it's always better. So you build a big radio telescope on the far side of the moon, and you observe the earliest times in the universe. You could measure the interaction of a global magnetosphere around an Earth-sized world as flares from the star are hitting it. And then they're giving off these flashes of radio emissions. We would discover habitable exoplanets purely by the radio flashes coming from their magnetospheres. Now that's amazing. So, and there are plans. So there's the ESA and NASA and China are all working on plans to build radio telescopes on the far side of the moon. Now, if you listen to the interview that I did, and we'll put a link in the show notes, there's a bunch of other ideas. A telescope at the South Pole built into a crater. You could sort of use the shape of the crater as a scaffolding for you to build this giant telescope. So there's a lot of really cool ideas. So check that out. Dougal, what's your confidence level for the Artemis launch in February? So like it's going to launch, and I am assuming that everything is just fine for NASA because we've already gone through Artemis 1. They've tested out the space launch system, the Orion capsule. There were some issues with the heat shield on the Orion capsule, but apart from that, the mission went exactly as hoped. So this time, of course, you've got precious cargo, you've got people on board. And so everything is going to need to be going without a hitch for them to be willing to let that rocket lift off. And the way things are configured, we get a launch window that opens up in February. And then if they're not able to launch during that window within about a week or so, they then have to wait another 3 weeks for the moon to be back in the same position. And then the launch windows open up again. So we have no idea. Right. But I've been through so many of these kinds of things, especially new launches of new vehicles, that they're so careful, so touchy, that they will scrub that launch for any reason whatsoever. They don't like the weather, they scrub that launch. Boats a little too close, they scrub that launch. And if any valve or monitor inside the rocket is causing any kind of concern, then they scrub that launch. And then they wait until they're ready to go again. And then only when it's perfect are they going to be willing to risk the lives of the human beings on that rocket as it goes around the moon. So what is my experience? I think, you know, we'll see a bunch of scrubs and then we'll see a launch probably within that first window. But your guess is as good as mine. If it turns out that they've been scrubbing launches for 6 months, I wouldn't be surprised either. So this is just how it goes with new hardware. George Gernescu, are there any current proposals for AI software in rovers or space probes to increase their capabilities? There's a lot of machine learning that goes into spacecraft already. There's a lot of tasks that spacecraft need to be able to handle autonomously. And I think the example that I give most often is the Mars Perseverance rover, which landed on the surface of Mars back, several years ago. And so when it was coming in, it was taking images of the surface of Mars. It had a landing ellipse where it was expected to actually land on the surface of Mars, but it was trying to pick its own landing spot with maximum safety. And the controllers back on Earth, you know, because there's a multi-minute delay, the entire landing system all comes together within whatever, 5-8 minutes. You don't have a lot of time to pick a landing spot. And so Perseverance had to choose its own landing spot. And so it was able to scan the terrain of the surface underneath it, find places that were largely rock-free, and then direct its final descent so that it could land at that place. And did that all autonomously. It had a machine learning algorithm that had been trained to both identify the terrain, figure out what is a good landing spot, what is a bad landing spot, and then direct its thrusters so that it could land safely like that. And there's been a bunch of other examples like that. And being able to explore the solar system beyond just instantaneous back and forth time is going to be critical. That you need to be able to say, and even on Perseverance, like you can now say, go over there, and Perseverance will handle the avoidance as it's driving over there. that it will drive around rocks. It will sort of consider the slipperiness of the steepness of the slope of the sand and all that kind of stuff and make a lot of these decisions. And so we see Perseverance putting many more kilometers under wheel than what we saw with any previous rover. And that's going to be the key, even on the moon. I mean, the moon still has a half second time, but can you imagine playing a video game with a 1,000 millisecond response time? That would be brutal. So you're going to want this increasing levels of autonomy. There's a lot of stuff that happens in space. Think about space telescopes, where there could be some bright flash that happens because a gamma ray burst is happening. You need the telescope to quickly turn and observe that object in under a second. You know, begin the process of making its observations. This all needs to be autonomous. So there's a ton of machine learning. And now because so much work is going into AI, this technology is getting better and better and better. You know, I don't think generative AI has any real value in space exploration. You know, you're not going to need a rover to be able to generate examples of astronauts riding horses or write text that's of any value, but machine learning, absolutely. And, you know, this is my hope with just AI, the rush into AI in general, is that all of this hardware is being built, all this infrastructure is being created, and most of it is just ridiculously used, like Sora, right? Like making videos of your friends getting stopped by traffic cops is dumb. But all that hardware, all that iron can be used for us to do science, for us to fold genomes, for us to search for signals from extraterrestrials, for us to learn how to identify craters on the surface of the moon. And I would love, if there is an AI crash, then I would love that compute to be cheap so that we can do science on it. In the same way, when you think about the internet, right, there's all that dark fiber. People thought that they would need all of this fiber. And so they installed all this fiber capacity and then it all crashed. It's all picked up for a fraction of the price. And the modern internet runs on that infrastructure that was laid down 30 years ago. All right, those are all the questions that we had this week. Thank you, everyone who asked your questions in the YouTube comments, everybody who joined me for the live show. Now, we are now making our live shows public here on the channel. We are no longer afraid of the tyranny of the YouTube algorithm. But watch them, and then that will give us the encouragement to keep doing this and not get torn up by the fickle algorithm. Now, I'm going to pull from the pile of spice and do another rant, thanks to one of the ideas from the patrons. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrea Pedretti, Bailey Griffin, Brian Bodie, Caredwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Baylock, Darkfinger, David Giltonen, David Matz, Evan.pro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, Nordspace, OneStepForAnimals.org, Porobok, Renkaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Father Munley, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, Wolfgang Klotz, and Zelda War Galactic Defender, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So as I mentioned in previous episodes, we have the Pile of Spice, which is how the patrons can summon rants. You know, whoever controls the spice controls the universe. Whoever controls the spice controls Fraser's rants. And so this rant comes from Lastborn. Should the AI slop ruin the internet as we know it, are you prepared to go back to full gloss print magazines? Or do you think a server farm such as Substack will be the commerce bearing spot for human originated internet media? Now, first, to be clear, I never had the full glossy magazine. You know, Universe Today was always internet based. I never made magazines, so I don't really have any experience. I wrote for Wired, I guess, briefly, but it's the same thing. So no, but like, I do have these romantical fantasies about like, would it be cool to make a print magazine version of Universe Today? And I think 10 years ago, it would have been a terrible idea. And now I think we could do something like that, you know, very small print run, send them directly to the people who have signed up for them. We put a lot of work into them, make them look really nice. That would probably work for a small print run. That would be really cool, actually. It would be beautiful. So many great pictures. We've got the words. Just need someone to desktop publish it together. And I think that there is this rise. You know, people are starting to shift away from the internet. You know, this whole idea of the dead internet theory, that more and more of the internet just looking to these ghost towns where AI is talking to other AI. and there aren't spaces that you, and even if it is people or maybe it's AI, they're being mean to you. And it's like, it's just not fun to be into that anymore. And so you're seeing this run to private communities and people are starting to get their information from voices that they can trust. Substack is a good example of a distribution platform. You know, we have an email newsletter. We use a different technology, but it's the same thing. And, you know, we're in this tough time for journalism in general, but I think there's been no better time to be an individual journalist right now, that if you have a compelling story to tell, if you're doing a kind of reporting that is important to a certain audience, then you can make a living from it, where people are just funding you directly. And it doesn't take many, like 1,000 people, 1,000 true fans will fund your career. And then you are bulletproof, right? You don't have to worry about an editor who's going to question your judgment. You're just going to report on the stories that are important to you and your audience. And that's kind of what we do with Universe today. I mean, we are fully supported by the patrons. We're a little more elaborate than a single journalist that's working. But the gist is the same. And I wouldn't be surprised that if, you know, 10 years from now, there is either mega corporations that are sloppity slop, slopping out as much slop as they can slop, or there will be individual journalists who are funded by their fans who want this kind of nostalgic, bespoke content, and they're willing to pay for it, and kind of nothing in between. So that's sort of the direction that I go. But yeah, let me know if you want to see our magazine. It's a terrible idea. We will never do it, but maybe. All right, we'll see you next time.